So, hello. Welcome back. Welcome. So, a little bit of review, just because there's a couple of you here who weren't here. So, for the weekend, the theme that I'm exploring and suggesting we get to know is recognizing in our experience the forces which come and inhibit, or that's a good word, disturb our beautiful, loving, friendly awakeness. And Buddha called them hindrances, and particularly the fifth one, which is doubt, doubting, and getting to recognize its presence and how it functions in us, which we focused on yesterday. And so its counterpart and its absence is trusting. And so today I want us to focus on this, the absence of doubting, and how to help doubting not be doubting, and how to encourage trusting, and how to recognize the difference, and just get familiar with the play of this, because this is, you know, what the Buddha's teaching, how to free us. Everything he teaches is the Dharma. He said the Dharma has one thing only, it's freedom. It's how to free us from the hindrances, free us from the oppression of and confusion of the ego, the separate sense of self, and the anxiety that's inherent in it, and freeing us from that, accessing therefore the true nature of who we are, and without that stress at all. So today we're going to talk about trusting. Beautiful state. Freedom's beautiful. However it manifests. So trusting, there's so many things. I've got a little tiny story about it. It's a true story. I have no idea where I heard it from. I read it in a book somewhere. There was a young woman who, I don't think she was young, there was a woman who lived in an apartment. And the wall of her apartment, living room, was next door to the bedroom of the next door apartment. And in that next door apartment were a young family with a little kid, a little toddler child. And they would routinely put that little toddler to bed in that bedroom beside her living room and say goodnight and do whatever they did. And it was not a very thickly walled, well-built, so she could hear. And then they would leave this little one, and then they would go and watch TV in their living room, and the little one would cry and cry and cry and cry herself to sleep. And she didn't know what to do about it. She didn't know whether to go knock on their door or to, you know, didn't want to be criticizing them as inadequate parents. She didn't know what to do, but she wanted to do, she lived there, she heard this crying. So she had this great idea. If I can hear the baby can hear me. And so she sang her to sleep every night. And so that little baby went from doubt to trust. It was soothed by this friendliness and relaxed and could sleep. It's as simple as this. I mean, it's a sweet, kind, lovely story, but we're the little ones, and we get upset by whatever, in her case, loneliness, and we get reassured and relax. And it's in that relaxing, that shift from the tension of self-concern to the opening and relaxing and trusting, that there's ease that enables us to, in our case, wake up, not go to sleep. It's a sweet story. So, doubt. I didn't say it yesterday, but I want to say it because it's a cute word. The Pali word for doubt is vichikicca. Kind of like that word because it makes light of, it could be a really heavy sounding word, but it's kind of fun in an English, in an English person pronouncing it, vichikicca. Nivarana is the name for the hindrances as a collective, and that particular one is vichikicca. And one way that the Buddha described us, and which we were practicing yesterday, to help free us, or at least, that's like suddenly it's either we're caught or we're free. It's like a black and white thing. But to soften or lighten or begin to make less dense. Remember, I talked about doubt beginning to reduce its hold. One way the Buddha recommended for all the hindrances is applying appropriate attention. This is a big tool appropriate attention, put our attention onto the fact that we're, which is what we were doing all day yesterday, the fact that we are in fact hindered, you know, our freedom, our well-being, our clarity, our presence, our openness is clouded up by our being caught in whatever we're caught in, our entanglement. Recognizing it, place our attention there, and oh yeah, trouble here, anxiety here, whatever it may be, whether you get the word there or you know exactly, it doesn't, you don't have to get it right, but just to recognize that you're not in a state of freedom, you're in some state of struggle and something's going on. And then when you can, if you can, recognize, oh yeah, this is actually this doubting, as I was suggesting, yes, just that goes from being doubting to knowing doubting has been here, and suddenly it's less. Keep placing appropriate attention, and withers is called the way, one of the translations, I love it, is the hindrances are withered by appropriate attention. They lose their oomph, their mom's in the frame, as I talked about yesterday, Calvin and Hobbes, and so Hobbes is not quite so significant and so real and so powerful. And so the reducing of the power of the hindrances through appropriate attention. And interestingly, in the same teachings the Buddha is giving about appropriate attention, he's saying if we apply appropriate attention alternatively to those awakening factors I talked about yesterday, by making those then conscious, appropriate attention really means being conscious of it. You know that it's happening, and so, oh yeah, this is what's happening, and you're noticing it. Appropriate attention grows the awakening factors. It withers the hindrances, it's growing the awakening factors. And when yesterday, briefly, I referred to the four foundations of mindfulness, and I talked about the fourth one, the dharmas, and that those are the two dharmas that Annalio has explored in his scholarly studies of the most ancient teachings and texts of the teachings of the Buddha, those are the two that we want to be aware of. This is what you do. Apply appropriate attention to them. You recognize, is there hindrances here? Is there awakening factors? Just get to know them. I teach retreats on seven factors of awakening because they are these beautiful factors that I was listing yesterday, and they are what enables our freedom, and the hindrances are what inhibits it. It's very simple and fascinating, and we know it works. So trusting is what's left when there isn't any doubting. It isn't something in itself. It's a state that's free from doubting, from worrying, from needing, from, you know, anxiety, uncertainty. And so it's got not, you can't, as I said Friday night in that longer talk, you can't, it doesn't have characteristics that you can recognize really. It's very little, very subtle. When there's an absence of anxiety or an absence of doubting, our shoulders go down, our breath becomes easier. We feel like it's fine to just keep sitting here. We don't have to do the next thing or go anywhere else, or nothing else is required. There's a surrender feeling, a relaxedness. There's often openness, like the little baby crying. You know, you hear that friendly voice and all that just kind of melts and you just soften. Softness. However, there are ways, as well as appropriate attention, to facilitate that, to facilitate the reassurance, to facilitate the trusting. And for each of us, we can find our own ways to do that. And so there are numbers of them, which I'm going to suggest we do. And so we can use our experiences, we can have imaginary and invite certain experiences or certain thoughts or certain images into our awareness to facilitate that, to reassure us. And I've already was saying yesterday and the day before and several times, one of the things when we're upset, which includes doubting, because it's underneath most of the things we're experiencing that are troublesome, we need some form of metta, some form of friendliness and kindness to reassure the crying baby of us who's upset. And that's a profoundly effective way of like reassurance. As soon as there's reassurance, we don't need to doubt and get into, I don't know what to do now. It's just soothe the self with some well-being, some gratitude perhaps, or some appreciation perhaps, or some, you know, some even just acknowledgement that you're upset. It's like, okay, yes. Like you do with a three-year-old, if anybody's ever been around a three-year-old who's crying, you pick the three-year-old up and you go like, oh, you hurt your toe, oh. And they know suddenly that you know, and it's like knowing it is like that, thank you, now you get it. So there's already some thinning down of that struggle. And so I did list a few of these things on Friday night's talk. You've heard, and I'll repeat some of them, and there are more I'm going to add today, of ways to place the attention, things on which to place the attention, experiences to call up, which bring that sense of trusting. And one of the biggest ones for me, just day-to-day life, and from, I think, most people, I'm a normal person, is nature. You know, as soon as we go, and why we need to go out into the park, and we need to go for hikes, and the weekend get away from all the human stuff, which is not that trustworthy. There are the trees, there are the mountains, there are the rivers doing their thing, there's the snow melting just as it should, the seasons, you know, water's going downhill just the way it's supposed to, you know, trees are going upwards just the way they're supposed to. They don't do it perfectly. They break and they lean and they get gnarly and they do it anyway, and life happens. I was talking this morning with Barb at breakfast, where, you know, who's my hostess when I come and stay here, and we're both gardeners, and talking about just being out there in the garden, and you learn all these things just by osmosis, by just having your attention placed in nature. You see what inhibits growth, what supports growth, the constant vitality of life that's always there, and it's reassuring. So nature, in whatever form we access it, gives us this. This is what it's supposed to be. The seasons are so in that way. I like marking the seasons. I told you a little bit of my witchy background. I like acknowledging the solstices and that we're now going to have longer days. And even if it's still going to be cold and rainy, and we're going to have longer days, and the summer is on its way. And that's reassuring. It's why we celebrate those. It's why the ancient peoples of Northern Europe celebrated the things they celebrated. They had 4 days they celebrated, actually, more than the solstices they celebrated. I'm going to get into a little witchy lecture here. The first day of February, it was called, was the beginning of when actually the springs began to spring. They began to actually, water was now melting and running. It was now, you know, rainier, and so they would go dress the springs. They still do in Ireland. I found a spring that was all had these ribbons and stuff in the branches around where it was. And that's the first of February, because now you can start working the earth, which of course was your survival. 1st of May was everything started to burst into flower. So that's the fertility day, and there's all lots of fertility activities that night, and the bonfires and the May queens and all. 1st of August is when you can grind grain. Wheat was the main food in that land, and you could, now it was ripe enough to, you started feasting. So the seeding was the first 3 months of the year, February to May. Flowering was the next 3 months of the year. 1st of August was feasting, because now you could harvest everything and finally eat it. And then from the 1st of November, which is Halloween, why that's still an ancient tradition, for the next 3 months, there's no earth activity. There's just hunting and eat whatever you've feasted, and the earth just goes to sleep for 3 months. And those were celebrated, and they're very reassuring. I find great confidence when I know that that's what always is going to be, that everything bursts into flower in May, is this amazing flowering month for a gardener. It's a beautiful month, and so on. Anything in any way that you can access that gives you that sense is reassuring you. The eagles are back, you know, so on. And the earth itself, as I talked about on Friday, the actual solidness of the ground of the earth, the solidness of rock. Because trust is about, to trust you have to lean on something. You want to be able to put weight on and be held by that actual activity. What can you... Where can you step? Where can you walk? Where can you place your trust? So you can rest down on something that will hold it. And that's solidity. And so that just, even some people practice element practice in their bodies as they do meditation. What's one of the practices that Bhikkhu Anālayo teaches in his body awareness that the Buddha taught, but Anālayo focuses on it. It's a beautiful practice of, you know, whether you're aware, you scan your attention through the body, aware of the 4 elements, starting with the most dense, which is earth, which is your bones, you know, and you can actually tune into and feel the bony part of your body, and the big bones perspective. You can really feel boniness in your thighs, those huge bones, and the pelvis, this big bowl of solid, round thing that you're all resting in, that's holding you there as you sit. You can really feel it when you're sitting in it, sitting in a big, dense bowl, with all that softness of the abdomen there. You can totally feel it. You know, your hands, you can feel there's bones in your hands and there's flesh on them. So you scan the body for bones. You can feel the hardness of the skull and the softness of your cheeks when you just can feel it. You can be aware of that. and so on. And in his practice, I loved doing this when I did this with him, practicing awareness of the bones in your body and then being aware of the bones in the earth. So there's the rocks and the mountains and all the hardness of the earth. And then you can be aware of your skirkana, of what's covering the bones is all the softness, all the flesh. You know, so that's all the wet. That's the wet moisture of your body. And you can feel it in all kinds of ways. You can really get into it and feel your eyes being slippery and your hands being slightly sticky with moisture and so on and so forth. The wetness in your mouth, all around your teeth and the tongue. But you can feel it in the fleshiness of the body as you scan your attention through. And then that's what's, you know, all the moisture of all the growing things, all the flora and fauna on the earth on top of the bones are all moisture. And then you can, the next one, the more subtle is the fire, you know, heat. And the way we can tell heat is through contrast. It isn't like an absolute, but we know heat by whether it's cooler or warmer. This is a cool piece of shade compared to a hot, you know, earth exposed by the sun. And so on our surface of our skins is where we can feel temperature. You can't really feel your temperature inside, but all around you can tell this hand is warmer between my fingers than on the outside of my fingers where there's just air. And so on, and where it's warmer on my body, just underneath my cuff here, and then it's cooler on the exposed. And we can feel all the contrast like that. And it's the same on the surface of the planet, because our temperature, unless you're deep down in the core of the planet, is all about the sun and whether the sun is exposing, you know, warming up the surface or not. So it's all about this contrast on the surface of heat and the experience of that. That's the heat element, inside and outside the same. And then the last one is air, which is the lightest and the most subtle. That's hardest to be aware of in our bodies. We can feel it with the expanding and contracting of the lungs because air is going in and out. But it's also, in Buddhist philosophy, the vibration. So you can feel that in the tingling of your hands, for instance, or the very subtle sounds that you hear, the ringing sounds. And that's the lightest, least accessible in a way. And, you know, how the air moves and the air we breathe and, you know, you can see it in the moving of the trees or the clouds and so on, and the space into the sky and so on and so forth. Anyway, the earth part, I got carried away there, but this is fabulous practice. I love that practice. But the earth element itself is that most reliable. And then with that, the qualities that we manifest as human beings, which are reliable, honesty, you know, loyalty, commitment, you know, when we keep our word, we trust that. You know, when we're around somebody and we know they're telling the truth, we trust them more than when they're trying to sell us a bill of goods, you know, and they don't, you know, used car salesman, hope there isn't one in the audience, but you know, convincing us of something being valuable and tricking us, and you know, we know that, we can feel what that's like. And when politicians are talking out the backs of their heads and not telling the truth, and when they're telling the truth, you know the difference. You know, and that feeling, we know that feeling. So what's trustworthy in those things? Our bodies, I should be quick because I've already said these things, but, you know, your the body and the way it's holding, it knows when it's afraid. It's trustworthy. It knows when it's safe and it relaxes and it can feel it. It knows when it's tired. It can, you know, if you don't know really what's going on, check with your body and it'll tell you. You know, you're... Even if it's, you know, you can't get the right word, it's confusion. It'll know that it's confusion, all right, you know. Yeah, the body, it doesn't lie. The body, you know, that's why they use lie detectors, because even if the person is busily, and their minds may be thinking that they're telling the truth, the body will register that wasn't the truth. When we lie, it's tense. When there's truthfulness, we relax. And the lie detector can tell that. We can tell that. We don't need lie detectors. We're lie detectors. Our hearts are lie detectors. Good friends, you know, our loved ones. One of the things we love about our loved ones is that we trust them, is that being with loved ones is reassuring. It isn't just that they like us and we like them. It's like there's that sense of, it's fine. So we love to be around those people that we love. And we like... safety, and this is another thing. And the first of the traditional, first of the traditional phrases taught with metta phrases, and the very reason why, in the first place, the Buddha taught metta was to allay fear, was about safety. You know the story of the monks who he sends off for their rains retreat to a great location, and this is a great forest, and you'll, there's a nearby village, and you'll be able to practice well here. And they go and they settle down, and all the tree spirits think, oh, a bunch of monks in our forest, and they don't mind for a day. But after a couple of days, they go, oh no, they're staying here. They don't want them here, so they start freaking them out and giving them weird sounds in the night and horrible smells, and they have this kind of disturbing energy, and the monks get freaked out, and they go all the way back to the Buddha and say, this is a terrible place to practice, it's scary, and we don't want to be there. And the Buddha says, it's a great place to practice, I know it well, I've been there, go there and practice. But what you need to do for these upset spirits is you need to love them. And if you send them all your loving friendliness, then they won't be upset with you being there, they'll be happy, and then you won't be frightened, and you'll be able to practice. And so that's what they do, and they go and send them. It's a metaphor for being safe and not being doubtful. Because they were being beset by their hindrances. And so when they overcame the hindrances by being reassuring. And so may I be safe and protected from inner and outer harm. We can't be safe and protected from the eight vicissitudes. We won't be protected from old age, sickness and death and politicians. It's not possible. This is this is not the heavenly realms here. This is the human realm, which is full of old age, sickness and death and accidents and weird people and hindrances. And so we can't be protected from that, but we can protect it from getting troubled by that. It's not the world that we're protected from. It's our own hindrances that we want to be protected from, that the Dharma protects us from. Inner and outer, other people's confusions and hindrances are our own. That's the protection. And it's protecting when we can have more clarity and more understanding and be kinder and not get triggered by, then we'll be more protected. That's how it works. Brilliant. And we can trust that. It works. We know it works. That's why we keep practicing. Another thing for accessing your own trust, well-being, very useful practice is to, from time to time, whether you're meditating or just from time to time, reflect on your insights, your own insights, and how they actually showed up in your mind. So we don't say hang on to your insights, because you can't hang on to them, because you can't make them come again and have that same insight. But you can remember and you can re-savor the impact. And do that regularly. It's called using your insights. Use them to remind you of what that feels like. Because the impact, when you have an insight, you know what that is. You know how that's, it's a moment of freedom. It's a moment of release. It's a moment of relief. It's like, oh, wow. And re-savor that experience again. And you will be re-savoring trusting again. Like, oh, yeah. So use those, because you have them, they're your own, when you saw that thing and that thought came to you, and it's like, yeah. So those are the things that are worth writing down on a retreat, just the occasional insight that help you access, not long for, but just remember, re-taste. So then we get to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and what the whole thing about refuge is. So the whole point of refuge is why, what is that about that tradition of taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha? So, I tell you, when I was there in Burma, I've told you, some of you have heard me say, it was so funny. They occasionally, well, quite a few times actually, more than I would have liked, I have to say, about 3 o'clock in the morning, somebody's radio goes on in the neighborhood. And it's a person who's got a, I don't know who they are, and I don't know if it would be the same one, but somebody whose radio is like massively loud radio, because most people don't have radios. And so they're offering their radio station to everybody in the village. So like goes for like 2 miles, like a super loud radio. And it's one of three things. It's music, which is a very subjective pleasure, let me say. Not my style. Or party political broadcast, which is basically sort of military, from the days that was, it was a little more oppressive, when I was there 10 years ago or so. Or chanting. And for some reason, the Burmese sense of music just doesn't gel with mine, and they seem to be really out of tune and really whiny, like, chanting. But it took me ages, maybe 10 days of listening, to realize they were chanting the precepts. and the refuges. They were chanting refuges and precepts, right, for everybody to hear. 3 a.m. The reason for the 3 a.m. is that, you know, by 4 a.m., everyone's really active there because it gets so hot by 11 a.m. that you're not active anymore. Like, you have to have a complete break from activity for several hours in the day. So they do all their household chores and do all their cooking and getting it together or whatever they're doing at 3. We had breakfast at 4 o'clock. The bell was ringing, you know, for us to have breakfast at 4 a.m. It's because of this climate, not because they're torturing themselves. I was thinking, what are they doing, making us get up? And then they go to bed really early, and then because that's when they get going. And so I would hear this racket going on at 3 a.m. And then I got to realize that they're offering to their whole neighborhood refuges in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, and how to live wisely. It was the most generous thing they could do. They're like, the first person to wake up, I'm going to do it today, I'm going to send out. And then you just get so inspired, and it's the sweetest of things. And to begin with, it's this dreadful racket, and it's all my response. Anyway, so these refuges, which are chanted in these countries many times a day, and at the beginning of every day, and at the beginning of every sitting, and at the end of every sitting, and so on, like it's a very devotional thing, has this meaning of bringing trust. And so what does it mean to trust the Buddha? Well, it's not the person of the Buddha, although the Buddha was just a person. But the Buddha was a person who, the most wonderful part for me, was he was able to explain awakening and how to help us access it. I mean, there's many, many awakened beings over the history of humanity. And some are able to help you and some aren't. They can just be it, which we can pick up on and get transmissions from and stuff. But the specific skills the Buddha so clearly laid out, which is why this tradition has been a functioning, active, working tradition ever since the days of the Buddha, 2006. It's the oldest practiced religion on the planet, organized. I mean, there may be, animistic practices that I don't know anything about that have been in, you know, tribes somewhere that we wouldn't necessarily know on the world circuit, but certainly a world-known religion, this is the oldest one, ongoingly, the same thing, same practices, same everything. To have the brilliance to be able to express it and teach us and make it accessible to people is the most incredible thing. And so that is worth revering. And I trust those teachings. So the Buddha doesn't mean the person who was this very clear-minded, awakened individual who could teach it. And did teach it. But it means the fact of Buddhahood. It's not that person particularly, but the awakened state. Do you think that your mind can become awakened? Do you believe, even a little bit, of course you do, you wouldn't be here, that our minds are where the hindrances happen and where freedom from hindrances happen? It happens in our own sense of consciousness. If we can trust our consciousness to be where awakening is and where it's accessible, that means taking refuge in the Buddha. It's trusting the mind, the mind's capacities. That's all it means to take refuge, to feel, to trust that that's possible for ourselves, and we do, or you wouldn't be meditating. And the Dharma is two things. It's the way the Buddha taught us to practice. It's our practice. It's doing the things we do and meditating as we do and listening to the explanations and everything. But it's also bigger than that. The Dharma has many translations. The word, one of its words is nature, which is interesting, you know, like the mountains are mountains and rocks are rocks and bones are bones and spring is spring and that whole thing. But it also means everything is the way it is. It's the truth it actually means. Another translation is truth. This is how things are. And we can, and if we can't, there's nothing else to trust but what's actually happening. This is the way it is. Not about liking it, not about approving of it, not about wishing or fixing, this is how it is. Whatever the this may be, whatever however that might be, that's what the Dharma means. And when we are able to be aligned with the truth of things, it's quiet inside. It's when we're not aligned with and we don't accept and we don't want it to be this way and we want to fix or control or improve or have it be some other moment that we're actually not with the Dharma and therefore we're not trusting. You can see once we're accommodating what's happening, it's because we're accepting, because we're in alignment with life. And most of our troubles are, and our dukkha is, because we're in conflict with life. We're contest with it rather than go with the flow. So this is where trusting comes in with the Dharma. This is how things are. It's how your life is, how I am. It's this way. And to take refuge in, or to be supported by, or to trust, place one's heart upon, I like that, place one's trust upon. The Sangha is meaning, the Sangha is, in this case, is people, awakened people, people whose minds are clearer. And it's not like you're awake or you're asleep. It's not black and white, none of this. It's moments, as Jack used to say, Jack Kornfield, I'm sure he still says, there aren't awakened beings, there are awakened moments. And awakened beings have lots of them. And unawakened beings have very few of them. And so it's like, because you know in your own experience, some of your moments are clearer and brighter and you're more open, and some of them you're really all caught up and tangled and triggered and confused, and therefore less skillful and causing more harm. And so there are a few, apparently, completely awakened beings. Steve Armstrong has this story. When he was newly in the monastery, when he went to Burma with Upandita, he had only been there a month. He was there 5 years, eventually. He had only been there a month, so he was the junior of all the monks. It's a big monastery. And they had one of their, which they do throughout the year, big celebratory days of some kind, some ritual day of sharing, some special thing. I have no idea what it was. In which there were many, many other monks and abbots from other monasteries there too. And so there were like 500 monks for this particular day. And what monks do is they process, you know, they take these processions to go from the meditation hall to the dining room and things like that. So they're walking along, going from the hall to the dining room, and he, being the junior monk, the newest ordained, is the most junior in the way they do this hierarchy thing. So, as you all know, so he's at the back of the line. And while he's walking along, he's so excited because he's a new monk and so full of enthusiasm. There's 499 of them ahead of him or whatever. And he's like, God, there must be some really awakened ones up. I bet there's an arahant up there. I wonder if there's somebody completely awakened, was how he was thinking. And so and he was walking along in the trail behind all these wise beings and loving it. And the next day he spoke to, after they'd gone their way, and he was next in conversation with Upandita, and he said to Upandita, he said, were there any arahants, you know, any completely awakened beings up yesterday here? And Upandita said, how would I know? Because it isn't like I have a label, like, you know, I'm awakened. You know, this is who I am. It isn't about self. It's like, is there consciousnesses that were free of selfing going on yesterday? Yes, there was lots of that. I just think it's a great story. Because we have this picture of like a person who's an enlightened person. Well, that's actually an oxymoron. If there's consciousness that's not confined to its separate self, then it's an enlightened consciousness in that moment functioning. And we're that way. In little moments that we don't even recognize, and the wiser one is, the less hindered one is, the more of that's available. So to trust the Sangha is to be able to trust that there are people waking up and have wise moments around us, and we need that because we can't do this by ourselves, because it's so counter to the survival mind and the, you know, the little program that we have of taking care of our separate senses of self, our little egos, that we need to have that from each other. We need to be in, you know, in the company of and listen to and be with people who are wiser than ourselves to help us. Oh yes, oh yes. Keep remembering. So that's what the refuges are. That's what they're to develop that sense of trusting. What is so subtle? This wisdom that we have, this potential of completely being minds free of all hindrances, are there already. And then they're cluttered up by all these anxieties and these things we do. But we don't trust that they're there because we don't know how to access it, because the other is so loud and disturbing and attractive and compelling. And so to trust something that's so, I use the word shy, those are wise states, are wholesome states, are generous, are empathetic, are quiet. They're kind of non-characteristic. We can't, you know, they're non-describable. They're unremarkable. And so we don't necessarily trust them because they're so ephemeral. Like, where are they anyway? What is wisdom, and what is serenity, and what is empathy? You know, like, You know, we know what anger is, we know what hatred is, we know what excitement is. They're loud and obvious and coarse. And these are subtle and shy and hard to trust. So part of the benefit of meditating and what the necessity of meditating is calming down all of the stimulating junk so we can start tuning into these more subtle, shy, which become ultimately the only thing we can rely on, you know, we can trust. So trusting those things is challenging for our coarse, upset, crying little pig pen minds, right? I don't mean pig pen like a, you know, a pig in the muck. I mean the comic character with his little, that's what I mean. I don't mean quite so pejoratively. Another thing that we can call up to trust, and it's the same root, is truth. And I've already said it, when we're with people who tell the truth, you go to some wise being, hopefully the doctors and the therapists, who'll actually tell you the truth and help you see what's true. And we want that, you know. When we don't know and we're confused and we're upset or we're ill or whatever it is, we want to know what's going on here so we can have that sense. That's just an example of the truth. We want to be with people who do tell us the truth. We want to know what's true for ourselves. We can only really cooperate and function as a society when there's truthfulness going on, when there's deception going on. It's punishable because it doesn't work for communication. It doesn't work for harmony, right? Truth is the only reliable thing. Another word for the Dharma. So trust and truth, that same root. Truthfulness. Just to reflect on truthfulness and how are you being truthful? I like this reflection when I think about this and talk about this when people are doing intensive retreat practice, the beginning, because of the silence. In the silence, we talk about speaking truthfully, taking the precept of truthfulness, except that you're being silent, so you're not going to be telling lies because you're not going to be saying anything. But actually what you're going to be doing is muttering away inside. And are you telling the truth inside? And a lot of what we mutter isn't true. Oh, I'm never going to be able to get this together isn't true. Or, oh, I am hopeless isn't true. Or, oh, you know, the comments we make, the little judgments we make, the whinings that we're going on inside the head, all that chattering, lots of it's actually not just junk, BS. It's not true, a lot of it. And so we can, you know, and when we are able to say, this is what's so, and we know that our inner speech is aligned with what is so, it's a relief. It's trustworthy. But those are just ways to access the feeling, and the point of the meditation and the point of our awakening isn't theory, and it isn't even technique-y like this, which are good techniques. It's then, subsequently, once we do call on whatever we can to generate for us more of a sense of trusting, is then to turn the attention to our experiencing of it, to our own trusting. So it's not, we're not dependent on thinking about the Buddha, but we use that to be able to then access my own feeling of trusting. What is this experience? Trusting. And I can know that feeling. And I can experience it. And so it's the consciousness of our inner experience is where we're going. It's not hooking it onto. Otherwise, it's dependent upon whatever these things we may use, which are wonderful things to use. But then it's a step. The next step is then being embodied in this sense of not doubting, not needing, not worrying. But now it's like being fully here. Yes, it's that quietness of awareness, which when there aren't those hindrances present, are trusting, are loving, are caring, are interested, are connected, these subtle states. So trusting isn't something, awakening isn't something, our true nature isn't something. It isn't a thing with characteristics we can really know. It's the absence of the other, absence of the confusion, absence of the doubting, absence of the sense of me busily wanting, commenting, whining, whatever it's doing. yearning, trusting. And so for some of us, it's easier to access trusting by observing the withering and disappearance of doubt. And for some of us, it's easier, and different at times, to actually invite something that generates more of that sense of refuge or safety or comfort, singing through the wall, lullabies to ourselves. And so you, and the whole thing with our meditation, it's a journey and it's an exploration. And basically, and I've said this, and you need to keep reminding yourselves too, that it's an experiment. It's an exploration of your mind and how it's doing what it's doing, and observing of it. But then, we try on. We pick up this lens, and we use these various Dharma tools and references. But we learn by trial and error. So you have to try and experiment, walking this way, or is the breath going to be what anchors me, or is kindness, or is gratitude going to be helpful today? And it's trial and error. But we mostly learn by the error part of the trial. Was this useful? Oh, this was only so useful. No, this wasn't useful. And then you try another. So it's trying and experimenting, seeing this is working, this is supportive, this is helpful, without hanging on and saying this is right. Because the next time you try it, it might not be useful. You might need to do another thing. And that's why it has to be your own experience and your own experiment and your own exploring. Our journey, our path to freedom is an endlessly exploring. And here's an image which I love. And years ago, I heard this teacher, Eugene Cash, if some of you know who he is, lives in the Bay Area. And I was teaching a retreat, and I was a student. And he said, and it was so striking, and I've always remembered it. I've repeated it often. He said, we are all, meaning human beings, we're all like blind baby moles groping towards the light. Groping. We don't know how we're going, you know, but we're going, we know that there's light, and we know we can sense it, and we go towards it. That's it. And how we do it, and how we grope, and how we learn it, we have to do our own. And, you know, we cannot be taught this. We can be taught how to grope and encouraged to, yes, you're groping well, yes, it's, yeah. You know, these are some of the ways that will help with the groping process. And so, you know, our discoveries then just like dawn on us. We don't know how that happens. Our insights just show up, they arise. It's like this spontaneous. The Dharma does that. The truth does that. It dawns on us. You don't do that part. You don't do your insights. You don't do your awakenings. You don't know your... That's why we have those words, realization. It's like a realization came to me, or just the lights went on, or wow, something showed up. It's this sort of, and it's magical, mysterious journey. We align ourselves, we make ourselves available, we try and unclutter, we try and recognize the clutter so it can begin to wither and, you know, become more conscious and less dominant, less caught. And then understandings will arise. They do. It happens. The Dharma does that part. We do the practice, and then the Dharma does the awakening. Trust that. And the more we do it, the more we trust it. So the practice itself, awakening itself, engenders this sense of trusting, which means there's less and less me doing and more of available, you know, available to. And so that's why Jogam Trungpa said, awakening is this accident that happens, but meditation makes us accident prone. It helps us be more and more available to the truth that's already here, that's shy, that's lurking in the corners, that's being, you know, outshouted. And with more trust, there's more relaxing, there's less striving, there's more waiting, there's more patience, there's more availability. There's a greater capacity to be with whatever it is, the truth of this aching knee, this uncertainty about my aging process, whatever. So there's increasingly trusting in our systems. But all these wholesome things we can't make happen, and we can't like demand or pretend or fake, but we can grope towards them and understand, or at least, you know, when we have moments of them, what that's like, make them more and more conscious. But As important, I would say, probably more so, and why the Buddha said first noble truth is there's struggle, is recognize it through the struggle rather than try and get around the struggle and get the trust. You know, as though the struggle, because that attitude then makes the struggle a problem, and it actually isn't a problem, it's just an experience. And so when we can experience that fully, then it's less in our unconscious and dominating us, and it's more like, oh, look, this... Oh, here's the mind, and it's struggling here. As soon as it's recognized, it's lighter, it's lesser, it's thinner. That's how it works. It's just not the way of the small mind. It's not the way of the marketplace. It's not the way of the survival ego's way. Not that that's wrong. That functions in perfectly well. This is this other. And why it's so tricky is it's so other. It's so radically not the way that we've always done it. So we keep using our old way to try and do this way. And so that's why it has to be this process, patient process of accessing our wisdom by recognizing and withdrawing permission for so much of the other behavior. I like that. So Christina Feldman uses that, withdrawing permission. When you plug, it's like I think of when you give permission to something, it's like you take a, this is my mind again, the way it works, you know, it's like take an electric plug and you plug it in, one of those big dryer plugs with three prongs, big thing, and you plug into something. And when you withdraw your permission from that thing, you pull the plug out. So you plug out, you disconnect from being so angry. It's like, I'm not going to keep being so angry. I'm not going to give my permission for that to keep running me. We can't do that unless we're conscious of it. So we get conscious, more conscious of it. Conscious of the moments of freedom, conscious of the moments of confusion. And we can only be conscious of them by being present. And we can only see all that by being aware, knowingly, ongoingly. Because you can't do it just in a quick little moment. It's a slow moment. That's the main training, is to slow down and lengthen out these periods when there's mindfulness functioning. This awareness of what's happening. I'm still aware of what's happening, and I'm going on being aware of what's happening ongoingly. And that's why we do retreating, so we can have the momentum of this knowing without the disturbance of, oops, suddenly somebody's irritated me and I've lost it. Okay. So today, it's the same as the trusting, same as the doubting, noticing the dusting and the doubting, and as it thins out. But for also see about ways for yourself that you can invite, access, and then experience in your being that subtle state of when there's no doubting, there's trusting instead. Any of those ways I suggested. But only that sort of cream on top of the main practice, which is extending those moments of awareness, right? Present mindfulness, that's the main thing we're doing. And the other is jewelry. You know, it's the elegant finessing of our practice. And you know, everyone's practice is different here. And you know, even somebody with great practice, lots of years of practice, in some, you know, you might be in some upset state and not be able to access doubting today. And it's just, I just want to just be in my body and be kind today. And so it's always going to be flexible like this. So dependent on your own experiences today, if you feel like accessing that part, that's my encouragement.